Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the Marriage Fitness Plugged-In Program with Mort Fertel. This is Mort Fertel, and this is your once-a-month Q&A teleconference. Welcome back to those of you that have been in the program for months, and in some cases even years, and a special welcome to those of you that are new to the Marriage Fitness Plugged-In Program. For those of you that are new, this teleconference won't be a surprise to you in terms of its format. It works the same as the Q&A teleconference in your previous Marriage Fitness program. That is, if you have a question, just press *6, and that'll cue you up. If you are called on to ask your question, please remember to start with your question. Again, start with your question. Then let's dialogue from there. You're all experts, or I should say veterans, and so I won't waste time on a lot of announcements. I hope to have a productive evening of Q&A with you. There were a number of emailed questions that I thought were interesting that would be valuable for everybody. So I'm going to hop back and forth between emailed questions and those of you live on the phones tonight and try to put out there a lot of good information. Let's start with a couple of emailed questions. Dear Mort, when my husband and I have any sort of confrontation, usually unintentional, I'm finding that when I get the same cruel, unkind response from him that I have over the last 27 years, it sucks the wind out of my sails and wipes out my motivation to stay on track with the Marriage Fitness program. Any tips on dealing with something like this, Amy? So over the course of all the resources that I put out there for you in my writings, my audios, in the program itself, also in the free emails, in my podcast, everywhere, I mean, I think I address this in a lot of different ways on a lot of different levels. There's a lot to this question and a lot to the answer. There is no one short, simple answer because, look, the truth is that you're all in situations where your energy is going to be sapped, drained sometimes by your spouse's disappointing responses or lack of responses to you. Put another way, it's not easy to stay motivated. That doesn't mean that there's not a good answer to the question. That doesn't mean that there's not a lot you can do to keep yourself on track despite the way your spouse might be behaving. But I'm just going to try to, I'm going to put something out there, and it's, you know, I just want to say in advance of putting it out there that it's a small taste or a small percentage of, you know, what would be considered a thorough answer to this question. That's the bad news. The good news is that I think you have access to the thoroughness that I'm referring to in all the other resources available to you. But what I think is worth repeating and what's been on my mind lately and comes to mind when I get this question from Amy is the importance of being proactive, not reactive. This is true not only in our relationship with our spouse, regardless of our marriage, but this is really so true in life in general. You cannot control or predict what the world will throw at you, what God will throw at you, what your brother, your sister, your mother, your friend, your boss, or your husband or wife will throw at you, how they will behave, how they will speak to you, with respect, without respect, with courtesy, without courtesy, proper language, improper language. You just don't have any control of it, and it's a crazy world out there. And you just don't want to be the kind of person who is reactive to the way other people are treating you. Instead, you want to be the kind of person who is proactive, meaning that how you treat people, how you respond to whatever comes at you, is not really a function of what's coming at you. It's a function of what's inside of you, who you are, what do you stand for, what are your values. This is why so much of what I'm sharing with you in the program and all my materials, I'm trying to help people and motivate people to clarify for themselves what are their core principles? What do they stand for? What do you believe in? What kind of person do you want to be? What do you want your legacy to be? How, what kind of influence do you want to have on the people around you as you walk through your day? You know, we all get a chance, thank God, to wake up every morning. And every morning we should think to ourselves, okay, God gave me another chance. He gave me another day. What am I going to do with this day? What kind of influence am I going to have? Am I going to be a positive footprint in the world? And to really do well at that, to really answer that question well, you have to be proactive, meaning that you have to be throughout your day the way you set yourself to be because it's who you want to be, not because you got lucky and people treated you well, not because somebody else made a choice that made it easy for you to respond in a nice, pleasant, easygoing way, but because that's who you are. And so this is a tremendous source of motivation, because when I am directed by this inner wellspring, by this set of core values that I'm just saturated in, then it really doesn't matter. Well, that would be an exaggeration. I'm not going to say it doesn't matter. But in terms of what I put out there and my motivation to be a certain way, it doesn't really matter how people treat me. You've heard me say many times, I have to admit, I love this line, we should never treat people the way they treat us. We should treat people the way we want them to treat us. And there's lots of reasons why I think that's true. One of them, of course, is just very practical, that if you follow that advice, it's much more likely that in the end, people will treat you the way you want to be treated. But there's really more to it than that. It's not just because practically I think you'll get the results you're looking for. It's because regardless of how people end up treating you, it's who you become by adopting that value, by looking at the world in that way, by being motivated by that saying, that value. It's just a better life. And I really do think this answers Amy's question, because this perspective offers this constant, ongoing, daily inner motivation that just never goes away. And it's not impacted by what comes at me today. And so just, again, this is a small piece of a complete answer to this question. But to me, this is central. This is really fundamental. And, you know, even if you don't review all the other materials and all the other different answers to this question, this alone can be such a tremendous source of direction and guidance and motivation. If you can really absorb this idea, remind yourself of this idea, and insist upon yourself to live like this, then you won't be derailed over and over again by anybody, because this is who you demand of yourself to be. And in a sense, when a curveball comes and someone treats you in a less than ideal way, it really just gives you a greater opportunity to demonstrate that this is really what you stand for. Because, you know, as I sometimes say to people who are in a difficult marital situation, you really have a better opportunity than I do right now to demonstrate that your love is unconditional, to really demonstrate this value that I'm sharing with you. Because really, how difficult is it for me to go home tonight after this teleconference and be loving and kind to my wife? What I mean by that is, it's relatively speaking, compared to all of you, it's not that difficult for me right now, because I'm going to get home. It's likely that there'll be this all-natural smoothie in the refrigerator that my wife always makes for me, that I love, that she knows I love. She doesn't drink it. She makes it only for me. And we have this ongoing little joke lately that almost the first thing I say when I walk in, other than hello and how are you, is there a smoothie? And usually there is, and she did it for me. And so, you know, when someone treats you that way on an ongoing basis, it's not that difficult to come in and to be huggy and kissy and warm and friendly. And it's just, you know, I'm not that challenged. But you all really have a greater opportunity to demonstrate that what I'm saying is not just something, not just words out of my mouth or your mouth, but that it's a real value that you live. You're challenged by it, and you're rising to that challenge. Okay. Let's do one more email question, then we'll go to the phones. This summer, my husband confessed that he's been in an affair for over 2 years with the intention to leave us, me and my two toddlers. As they live in different continents, they are meeting every 2 months. He's still been living with us, and I've started to apply some recommendations from your program. Despite that I can see some improvements in our communication and he notices changes in my behavior, his affair is developing further on quickly. They are planning new trips, and I feel trapped in a kind of slavery relationship, being kind and nice, taking almost all the care of our children and he going to the trips with his mistress and taking all the advantages of a double life situation with not any clues of remorse or compassion to my feelings. How can I motivate myself to proceed with your program in such an awkward situation? So I don't think I chose this question so wisely because I apologize, because I think I just actually gave a good answer to the question in the previous question. So Renata, I think I answered your question in the previous question, and I am going to move on. So let's go to the phones.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, this is Katie.
Okay, Katie, good evening.
Good evening. My husband and I are starting the program over again. We failed miserably the first time. So our question is, how should we handle a new problem that arises, not discuss it? Because your whole program is based on setting problems aside. And a lot of times the problems that come up are a result of some built-up resentment due to a bigger problem from the past that was never resolved. So how do we go about discussing current problems?
Well, yeah, like you said, I don't know about the whole program, but an important premise to the methodology is that you should temporarily, key word, temporarily put problems and issues aside, because if your first attempt in the program failed miserably, then that leads me to believe that you don't have very much goodwill or connection built up between you. If you try to address those problems, discuss and attack and resolve those problems in a marital environment where there isn't goodwill and connection, you're going to beat each other up. You're not going to be productive. You're going to try to win. You're going to try to be right. You're not going to be motivated to be compassionate or understanding. Or, you know, I don't want to be too repetitive of stuff you've already heard from me in the program, but for all the reasons I've discussed, despite people's good intentions, problems don't get resolved when you try to resolve them in a poor marital environment. So, I don't think there's anything really unique about the question that you're asking. I don't think, unless you want to clarify for me. I mean, there's nothing really unique about a problem that is, quote, new, that's your word, versus a problem that is, you know, a few years old. The relevant matter is that there's a lack of goodwill and connection. You haven't really employed the program successfully and improved your connection, and therefore, it's not time to address the problems. So you're really asking a question that is answered by sort of marriage fitness 101, you know, one of the basic premise of the whole program, which is, yes, to take those problems and issues, to temporarily put them aside and just go to work trying to build some goodwill. You'll be much more successful returning to address those issues once you've done that than trying to address them now. Does that answer your question, Katie?
Yeah, I believe so. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the question. I kind of sensed from her response that wasn't what she wanted to hear. but anyway.
Hi, Mort. It's Christina.
Hi, Christina.
Okay. Hiya. How are you? Happy New Year.
Thank you.
So I've been, well, as you know, been in the program for about 8 months, Lone Ranger. So my question is, with the whole temporarily putting aside the problem, similar to that, but my question is, would it be okay to have a check-in with my husband and try and get some clarity on how he is feeling? Because I just feel so confused about what's going on in his head, because he's not communicating with me, he's not living at home, we are separated, he ignores me, but yet his clothes are still here and all paperwork's still here. And so I just feel, whilst I'm trying to employ all these practices really diligently, I just feel in limbo, and I don't know is there a right time where I can check in with him and not necessarily bring to the table all the problems that we have, but just to find out whether he's still of the same opinion, which is that, you know, he doesn't want to fight for our marriage, basically.
Not a good idea. Not a good idea at all. What's the purpose? I mean, I understand how it would satisfy some curiosity for you. I certainly understand the desire, the impulse to ask that question. But as a practical matter, you know, my job is to try to help you stay on course and to be practical and to try to, you know, step by step chart a course that's likely to help you nurture healing and reconciliation. And you know, asking those questions and having those conversations tends not to be productive. In fact, worse than that, it tends to be destructive. Because let me explain why, or I'll mention one reason why. There are many, but this is one. Because as soon as you open your mouth and engage in a conversation like that, ask a question like that, you've just taken the relationship, which is very emotion-based, and you've transformed it into an intellectual endeavor. What do I mean by that? A conversation like what we're having now is a matter of the intellect. It's something that's going on in our heads. We're asking questions. We're providing answers. Now, in our context, that's appropriate, because what's the purpose of what we're doing here? I'm not, you know, our primary goal. I mean, I hope we're building, some sort of a relationship between each other on these teleconferences, but it's not exactly a personal relationship, right? The primary objective of what we're doing is I'm trying to transmit information that you can utilize in your marriage healing. So conversation and words are the appropriate mechanism for doing that. But in your relationship, where it's really important is, you know, it's the emotions. It's what you feel for each other. And as soon as you ask that question and engage in that conversation, you're now asking your husband to translate those emotions into some intellectual dialogue, which he may or may not do authentically, right? Because once you ask that question, it's not like, you know, it's he's in the courtroom and he's under oath and he's going to answer you truthfully. You realize that? Like, when we have a question for our spouse, we assume that, because we think if we were asked the question, we would give just a straight answer. But really, do we always? We don't always, especially in personal relationships. Very often there's all kinds of feelings and thoughts and dynamics that are going on that result in us giving a less than authentic answer. For example, because I'm fearing that this might be coming across as a little abstract. So, for example, when you're dealing with an obstinate spouse and who's somebody who has previously decided that they want to have an affair, they want to get divorced, they want to separate, they want to derail you from your efforts, they want you to give up so they don't have to feel like they're such the bad guy, but there's mutual consent that this marriage is over and it's dead, right? So you could be treating them consistently in a way that's really successfully tugging on their heart, that really is creating some kind of connection, that really is getting them to second-guess their choice, that really is tugging on their heart and prompting them to consider to make their own effort. They may not have yet, but that may be going on within them. Then you ask them this question, which now pushes everything to this intellectual endeavor that's going to occur in this dialogue. You think they're going to reveal all that? You think they're going to be authentic about how your efforts are impacting them? No way. They're going to go back to their agenda, and they're going to answer you based on that agenda. In other words, they're going to tell you it's over, it's nice that you're trying, but it's not making a difference, my feelings haven't changed. But none of that is true. It's all agenda-driven. It's what they want to be true. It's what they want you to think is true, so that you give up, so that you stop trying, so you cooperate, whatever. I'm giving a hypothetical example. But I'm giving an example to emphasize the point. I'm trying to explain just one reason why asking that kind of question is not helpful. And you shouldn't do it. And by the way, once you do ask the question, and they do give an answer that's agenda-driven and inauthentic in the way I just described, so then they become more invested in that answer than being true, right? Do you follow what I'm saying? In other words, it's not just that it's not effective. It's that asking such a question could be very counterproductive, because the more I articulate something, the more I say something, the more invested emotionally I become in being right. You know, it's like with, I don't know if this is the best example, but it's coming to mind, so I'll just share it. I think you'll get it. It's like with elections. You know, now these days elections are very polarized. People pretty much have decided who they're going to vote for long before the campaigns. And I don't know how many people actually change their minds. But hypothetically, you know, let's say that you really were indecisive about who you were going to vote for in such an election. And the time came to have a big discussion amongst your friends. And for whatever reason, maybe something happened that day in the campaign such that you started to articulate that you were going to vote for and you were in favor of person XYZ. And you put it out there. And you told your mother, your brother, your sister, your friends, this is what I think, this is who I'm going to vote for. The fact that you said that, the fact that you made that public, makes you now emotionally invested in following through with that vote. Even if later in the campaign things changed that might have otherwise influenced you to vote for somebody else, you're less likely to make that change because of the fact that you articulated and even articulated publicly certain feelings beforehand. So you don't want to create a situation where your spouse is articulating and therefore becoming more and more emotionally invested in a certain negative position, because you're making it more difficult for yourself to turn things around, for them to eventually concede that, yes, you have changed. Yes, they are feeling differently. Yes, they should make their own effort. And yes, they are going to give it another chance. Okay.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Great.
This is Vesna.
I'm sorry, what's your name?
Vesna.
Vesna, okay.
Yes.
Good evening.
So I have a question, how to handle the situation when, let's say, the mistress calls my husband and we are spending the evening together watching TV. So I'll just give you a little bit of background information. So he's been having an affair for the past 3 years. I've been in the program for 10 months, and now finally a month ago I see a big change, big improvement in our relationship. You know, everything is looking much better. You know, we are connecting, we are intimate. So I was pretty sure that the affair was done. We never discussed it. But based on his behavior, I thought that he broke up. And then 2 days ago, you know, we are watching TV in the evening, and his phone, he saw the missed call, and he told me, oh, you know, I'm sorry, I have to call her. That's, you know, the mistress. And, of course, I got upset, and I said, you know, I thought that this was over. And then he said it was, but, you know, we haven't talked to each other for more than a month. But I see that she called, and I have to call her back because probably something happened or she might need my help or whatever. So he left. He was sitting in the car.
What's your question? I get the
idea. So my question is how to handle the situation like this if this happens again.
So I don't think you have to have to wait for it to happen again.
Okay.
I can see what's going on here. It sounds like you've made great progress, and I'm happy to hear that. And you should leverage off the emotional capital that you've succeeded to build up and look for the opportunity to educate your husband about what it means to rebuild trust, what it means and how one goes about rebuilding a marriage post-infidelity. He seems to be clueless. He seems to be ignorant. He seems to be foolish in how to go about that. I mean, for him to, like, with a straight face tell you, I have to pick up the phone and call her back, but it could be that she needs me and is in trouble, it's like such a, I mean, it's laughable, but he doesn't realize how laughable it is. What are you talking about? In front of you is your wife. She needs you. She's in trouble. And you just chose your ex-mistress over your wife? What's wrong with you? But he doesn't realize it. He thinks he's being a nice guy. He thinks he's somehow doing the right thing, and this is excusable. This is, he doesn't understand what it means to rebuild trust, to rebuild a marriage post-infidelity. So if he was still deeply in the midst of the affair and you hadn't told me you made progress, and I would never suggest that you try to educate him, but under the circumstances, he probably means well, and I'm sure he's thrilled about the progress in the marriage. He's just ignorant about how to handle himself in a situation with an ex-mistress when a marriage is on the comeback. And you need to try to help educate him. Now, of course, how do you go about doing that? That's a whole other question, which I'm not going to get deep into, but I'll just bullet point a couple of options. So if he's open to it, you know, you could introduce him to some of the sections in the program that address that. For example, there's a section in the program where I talk about, you know, post-infidelity 101, which is severing all contact with the ex-mistress and how trust is the foundation of a marriage. And it's stupid. It's just foolish to think that you could possibly rebuild the trust with any contact with the mistress. So anyway, one possibility is to, you know, introduce him to certain sections of the program, the section where I talk about three pillars of trust, which is different content that I just referred to. So that's one possibility. Second possibility is to just discuss it with him, to try to, you know, explain to him. That's less likely to be effective because he's hearing it from you as opposed to a third party, and that's, you know, less likely to go well, but it's an option. Another possibility is to, schedule private sessions with me, with either David, Elise, or Mimi, or with somebody local if there's somebody that you trust. you know, to try to help you guys, try to help him, really, well, you too, but really try to help him understand, you know, where to go from here and what and how he has to conduct himself regarding the mistress. So it's great that you've made progress. It sounds like you're on the right track. And I'm sure your husband has good intentions. The fact that he shared with you, it's she that's calling. From his perspective, he's being honest with you, and he's being like a nice guy to her. I can imagine that his intentions are in the right place, but he's just ignorant, and he just doesn't have any experience as to how these things really work and go, and what his responsibility is, and what's effective and ineffective, and how to view this. He needs help, which is not surprising. So you have to try to use the emotional capital that you've built up and the connection you have and the way he probably values you and the marriage now more to lead him into some marriage education, really. Let's do a couple of emails. Do I continue to pretend/ignore his affair? I'm in Lone Ranger 4 months, and my husband of 20 years is having what he thinks is a secret affair with his 20 years younger coworker, who's also married and has two little children. They share sublet a secret apartment that uses significant money from our family funds. I learned this via spying, which I have stopped. He pretends everything is great with us, but our sex life is barely existent, as he is with her every weekday. I believe he wants to continue with this dual life, as he is convinced he will never get caught. Do I continue to pretend he is a faithful husband when I am scrambling to pay bills? Amy, so the question here is loaded because words are being used that have certain implications. I don't know if I, you know, sort of like what they're communicating. Like, for example, do I continue to pretend, you know, as if not calling your husband on the carpet for his, quote, secret affair is you pretending that you don't know. Again, the word pretend, it bothers me. It has like this very derogatory connotation as if you're doing something wrong, something foolish, something sort of inauthentic. And I just don't see it that way. I think that, you know, there are things that husbands and wives should share with each other, and I think there are sometimes things that we should keep to ourselves. And sometimes keeping things to yourself is a wise choice. Sometimes it's an effective choice. Sometimes it's a very good exercise of personal and emotional restraint. So you see how I just reframed all of that? Like, just thinking of it in that way makes it feel very different than when you frame it in this idea of, you know, you sort of pretending. The word pretend, again, just has such negative connotations. And I don't see what you're doing as being so negative. Now, I see what he's doing as being very negative. But and if you continue to live this way for 5, 10, 15 years, I would see that as foolish and negative. But for you to be doing it for a few months while you try to turn your marriage around, I don't see that as foolish at all. I don't see that as anything negative. I see that as wise. I see that as strategic. I see that as intelligent. I see that as very disciplined. And, you know, the affair is very likely to run its course. It's very likely to end. If these affairs always die, and they tend to die faster when you just kind of get out of the way and leave it alone and let them run their natural course. the more you try to get involved and confront them and derail them and challenge them, and that doesn't help. In fact, very often they just double their efforts and want to prove to you that you don't control them and that their relationship is not going to end because of you. And so I'm not advising you to pretend anything, but I am trying to educate you that confronting somebody about an affair when your relationship lacks the goodwill that is necessary to create any influence on one another is foolish. You'll feel good at the moment you do it. Don't let him get away with it. Call him out on the carpet. Don't let him think he's getting away with it, you know. And in the moment you do it, you'll feel good. But it won't help. It won't be productive. And, you know, as you've heard me talk about in the program, you know, I'm much less concerned about how you feel today. I'm much more concerned about the state of your marriage 6 months ago. And it's quite common that we have to compromise or sacrifice, you know, how we feel today to position ourselves to end up where we want to be 6 months from now. Okay. Let's do another email question. Please give us a reminder on infidelity and how to deal with the painful emotions that come up. I've listened to your recordings over and over, as many of us have. It would be great to have a refresher, as some of the recordings are older. When your spouse thinks they were in love with a mistress, and how does one deal with this painful thought? How does one not feel like a doormat and maintain self-respect while putting all the issues and betrayal behind us? How does one do all the tasks in the program without looking desperate, but rather maintain an attractive self-confidence? Anna. Okay, so there's a lot of questions there. And again, this is such a big topic that, you know, you have lots of resources available to you. So my goal here tonight is just to kind of tease out one particular idea that might be a good partial answer to the question and a healthy reminder. What jumps out at me in the question that motivates me to remind you about is that your dignity and self-respect does not come from how people treat you. It comes from how you treat them. And so I think when we feel like a, quote, doormat, or when we feel that our self-confidence or self-respect is threatened because of how people treat us, then it's a reminder to us that our confidence, our self-respect, and our dignity, we are drawing it from the wrong source. And that's something I should feel good about me, not because of the luck that comes to me in terms of how people decide to treat me. I should feel good about me because, and I'll tie this into a previous question, because I've really worked to clarify who Mort Fertel is and what he stands for. And I've succeeded consistently to conduct myself incident by incident, relationship by relationship, moment by moment, in alignment with those values. And when I do that, I earn the right, and the result is that I feel good. I feel confident. I feel like I have self-respect. I feel like a dignified person. And the result of my actions, the outcome doesn't really affect it that much. I mean, you know, like somebody who starts a business, and you know, they're conducting themselves in unethical ways, and lying, cheating, and stealing, but they succeed to make a lot of money. how do you think they feel about themselves? Driving around in their fancy cars, living in their fancy house, and wearing their fancy clothes. They look great, but really, think about it when their head hits the pillow at night. You think they have a lot of self-respect? You think they have a lot of self-confidence? You think they feel like a dignified, majestic person? I don't. I think there's a lot of sadness. I think there's a lot of regret. I think there's a lot of doubt. On the other hand, let's say somebody starts a nonprofit with the purest intent and the most worthy objective. And they spend a lot of time and energy trying to succeed with this worthy cause. And they really go about it in the right way, administering every dollar that was raised carefully and honestly. But they fail. It happens sometimes. The outcome is not what they hoped for. But how do you think they feel when their head hits the pillow at night? Of course they're disappointed that the outcome wasn't what they imagined. After all, their goals were honorable. But how do you think they feel about themselves? I think they feel great about themselves. They tried valiantly. They conducted themselves honorably. They made sound decisions. They maintained their integrity and didn't cut corners. Okay, they wished the outcome would have been different. But I think inside they feel like a person of majesty. I think inside they feel like a person that has dignity, self-respect, and confidence. Okay, let's go on.
Hi, Mark. This is Glenn.
Okay, Glenn, good evening.
You may have already answered my question, but I'll give it a shot anyway.
Okay.
Should I tell my wife after, I don't know if you need my whole situation, but should I tell her how I found out about her affair, her mister's name and his wife's name? And after 21 months and four affairs, the affair ended. She stopped all the divorce proceedings.
Wait, hold on. I don't know that I need any of that to answer your question. So is she asking how you found out?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And is she in the program also?
No. She stopped the divorce proceedings, but she still wants a separation. She still hates me. And the other night I was not very good. I wasn't very nice to my wife. I apologized for how I treated her, and I told her I would expect more of myself.
Yeah. How did you find out that information?
Actually, I found out from her. She talks loud on the phone, and, you know, after 2 years, a name here, a name there, and Facebook, and, you know.
So you just overheard, and that's the honest answer to the question.
That's the honest answer, and I told her I heard from her, but she doesn't believe. She thinks
so. So here's the answer to your question, and then I'll offer a little commentary just so people can try to apply what I'm offering to their situation as well. In your situation, I emphasize, in Glenn's situation, I think that you, Glenn, should answer your wife's question. I think that you should tell her how you found out. But let me offer some commentary now so you understand why I'm saying that, and others can apply this to their situation. You might not come out with the same answer. Those kinds of questions, the operative question that should be asked in order to determine whether or not those kinds of questions should be answered is, how would that help with the healing and reconciliation, if at all? Can that information actually be productive? Let me give you a simpler example, simpler than Glenn's. Very often post-infidelity, people, the betrayed, and I realize that Glenn's wife is not the betrayed, she's the betrayer, but nonetheless, very often the betrayed are asking questions that are understandable, but the answers to those questions won't be productive in terms of the reconciliation. For example, you know, last December you told me you were here, but really were you there with her or with him doing this or that? That kind of questioning is not helpful. We know there was an affair. We know there were many lies. And the details of every lie are meaningless and are a terrible distraction and aren't helping us move forward. They're actually getting us stuck in the past. In addition to that, very often, revealing those details can be more helpful than hurtful. And so the operative question is, you know, can the answer to this question help in the healing and reconciliation? I'll give you another example, which shows when it can be helpful. What were you getting out of your relationship with this Mr. or mistress that you weren't getting in our marriage? Okay, the answer to that question, by the way, could be very painful. However, it's an important question we have the answer to because it could be incredibly helpful. And so that's the kind of question that should be asked and answered. So in the case of Glenn's wife's question, I'm not going to argue that the answer to the question is going to be helpful because it won't be. It's a meaningless question. It's the kind of question that somebody asks that's motivated by meaningless curiosity. But the answer to the question, I don't believe, will be hurtful. And so since the information is pretty innocuous, you might as well just answer it. What's the harm? It might be a good idea to try in answering the question to explain the distinction that I just offered so that your wife doesn't have the expectation that you will kind of mindlessly answer, that you will just indiscriminately answer any question like that that she asks, but that instead what you're really interested in is moving forward in a productive way. Okay. Let's go on.
Hello, Mort. This is Lisa.
Good evening, Lisa.
Hey. So I actually have two different questions, and maybe you can choose which one you'd like to answer. First of all, I've been following the program for about 8 months. My husband filed for divorce, and I worked really hard. He dropped the paperwork or dismissed the paperwork, moved home, which was fantastic. And then about 30 days later, he left again and refiled his papers. So just curious to hear your perspective on that. That's kind of one question. And then the other question is, given our current state, we're kind of hurtling down the road toward a custody battle, which, you know, from everything I've heard from you, we should always try to talk about the kids, like, outside of our relationship, and that just doesn't seem to work. It always escalates into some horrible fighting, and who's more selfish and all of that. We just don't see eye to eye on that. I continue to try to promote goodwill, but anytime those conversations come up, it just doesn't work. So I guess the two questions, one, given my odd situation of reconciling, but then him leaving again, like any thoughts on that? Or the other one about how to deal with...
So which one do you prefer me to answer? Because I have a long line here.
Honestly, the first one.
The first one, yeah. So, look. Sorry, I just accidentally muted myself. So on the first one, look, these situations are volatile. And I'm sure you were thrilled when your husband moved home and stopped the divorce, and you thought, ah, you know, great, I made it. You know, we're moving in the right direction. And you were. And it was a result, I'm sure, of great effort on your part. But these situations are volatile, and, you know, there are setbacks sometimes. And you just have to, you know, keep your eye on the target and keep plugging away. I mean, in a sense, you have kind of an extra disappointment to deal with that a lot of people don't have to deal with. But on the other hand, you also have, you know, confirmation that many people don't get, which is that your efforts can make a difference. They can reach him. They can tug on his heart. And they can really influence, you know, his choices. And so, you know, I think it's important that you demonstrate to your husband that your efforts are real, that they're consistent, they're coming from an inner wellspring of transformation, that they're not manipulative, and that, you know, whether he's home or leaves, whether the marriage is intact or he's filing for divorce, whether you're, you know, parenting nicely together or he's battling you for custody, that you are employing these principles and practices and demonstrating yourself to be a kind, loving, generous, considerate, affectionate wife, and that all of that is consistent. And the more you demonstrate that, the more likely it is that he'll not only come home, but he'll stay home and realize that, you know, this is an amazing woman that is going to be an amazing woman no matter what comes up, and I'd be lucky to have her as a wife. A year and a half ago, my husband told me he had affairs for 2 years with women who really liked kinky sex. He was leaving me because we didn't have a connection anymore. I started your program, expanded our intimacy, and explored new things to my limits. We do everything together. He now says, you and me together forever and always. Though he still thinks it is perfectly fine to send flirty texts to his sext friends and will ask for threesomes or be polygamous so he can have variety. I've been avoiding these conversations as much as possible. I told him his behavior hurts me. Should I tell him something more or do something differently? I don't want to leave, but it also hurts. I feel stuck. Thanks, Connie. So a few things, Connie. First of all, it could, you know, there might be a few reasons why your husband keeps putting out these suggestions for these acts of perversion. Part of it, I'm sure, is that these are interests and fantasies that he has. But part of it might be because you are giving him some reason to believe that his bids for these things might be accepted. Maybe. I don't know. All I know about you is what I just read. So don't take that as an accusation, but just as something to consider. And if you think that there's any truth to that, then you might think about why he might think that that is even within the realm of anything that you would consider. And you might try to conduct yourself going forward and respond to him going forward in a way that just completely closes that door. Do you know what I'm saying? In other words, I don't think he would even flirt those ideas out there. He might think about them, but thinking about them and actually inviting your wife to participate in them are worlds apart. Really, huge difference. Again, the fact that he puts it out there means that in his mind, there's some chance that you might be accepting of that. So I think you have to shut that down. That's number one. Number two is, similar to my response to a previous question, it sounds like you two have, you know, made some progress and built up some goodwill and, you know, made a lot of changes. I think you have to try to use that emotional capital to put you and your husband in a situation where he might be educated about the impact on a marriage of these kinds of things. That's just, you know, he's ignorant, again, foolish, and doesn't understand how floating these ideas can be so hurtful. No less actually, God forbid, engaging in such things could be, you know, just really disgusting, destructive, not only to the marriage, but how damaging it could be to him and his legacy and, you know, the kinds of values that his life promotes. And so maybe you could figure out a way to put him or yourselves, you know, in the influence of some ideas and values that might influence the way he, you know, the way he thinks about these things. Let me take the opportunity here just to remind everybody that, you know, this is what I'm about to say here is so obvious and also so incredibly difficult to keep in mind. And that is that every single day we are surrounded by influences, values and ideas that influence how we see the world and how we act in the world and craft our life. And a lot of those influences and values and ideas are coming, you know, we're absorbing them through our eyes and our ears in ways that are not thoughtful. We don't even realize it. You know, like just as an example, when you decide to watch a movie, I mean, do you know anything about the person who wrote that movie? Do you know anything about their agenda? Who they are, what they stand for? What kind of ideas, concepts, and values they are trying to promote? Because usually the answer to that question is no. We have absolutely no idea, right? We watch a movie because we want to be entertained, because we want to feel good. But we're exposing ourselves to the teachings and the influence of another human being. Now, maybe they're a good influence, and maybe they really are trying to promote good values, but maybe not. And, you know, every time we click on a website, every time we watch a movie, every time we interact with a person in any significant way, any time we open a book, if anybody opens a book anymore, you know, we're absorbing the values and the influences of you know, of other people, and so the question really is, you know, what are those values that you want to stand for? And if you really give that deep thought, the chances are very good that the answer to that question is what you really want to stand for is something very different from the values that are being promoted and are easily accessible in popular culture. And so in order to really embody those values and be influenced by them, you've got to be very deliberate about saturating yourself and surrounding yourself with people and influences that promote those values. Because just as, you know, what you eat and consume through your mouth influences dramatically the health and condition of your body, so too what you consume through your eyes and your ears influences dramatically your spiritual and emotional state. There's no difference. There really is no difference. And so you just have to be very careful and very deliberate about what you're consuming through your eyes and your ears. Okay. Let's go on.
Hey, Mark, can you hear me?
I can. What's your name?
This is Sarah. Sorry, I just took a bite right as you turned me on.
No problem. Good evening. How are you? Tara, you said?
Good. Tara, yes. Tara.
Okay. Tara, what's your question?
Okay, so my question has to do, you do a really good job of helping me understand how to handle not talking about the affair with my husband while he's still in it, but my end, like, you know, when he wants to normalize it, we don't want to do that, right? Push it down, don't talk about it.
Correct.
My question is, what about when he seems like he's trying to say sorry and he's trying to apologize, but there's like this caveat that they're still friends? That's what I ran up against this last month with him, was he finally wanted to tell me about it, like on his own,
mm-hmm.
in an apologetic sort of a way.
Mm-hmm.
Saying he was sorry, telling me it's over, but then he also told me that it was still going on. And so at the time, I was able to effectively talk about things that were a little bit more productive rather than that specific thing. But I know that there's other things coming, and I'm trying to figure out how do I deal with it moving forward.
That's a great question. Great question. Very interesting question. Here's what I would suggest. First of all, he's trying to apologize. It's not an easy thing to do. And, you know, there's a Eastern teaching that says if you're going to bow low, bow deep or whatever it is, you know, like if you're going to apologize, you know, you should be deeply apologetic and remorseful. But it's not easy to do that. And very often when people apologize, they're like simultaneously trying to hedge and cover themselves and, you know, not be too effacing. So it could be that your husband really means well. He wants to apologize and he feels bad, but it's not an easy thing to do. It could be he's not getting good coaching. It could be he hasn't really thought it through. It could be he's battling a lot of sort of inner demons and is not really very, you know, and not doing it very well. So you should give him the benefit of the doubt and realize that, you know, what he's trying to do and what he is doing to some extent is a very big step, very, very big step. And so the first thing I would do is I would make a big deal out of that step. And even in your response, even kind of crystallize in your response what he's trying to do. In other words, you might even be better at saying what he's trying to say than he is succeeding to say it. And if your response does that, I think he'll really feel good that he's doing the right thing, that he's being understood. And, you know, it's just a very, I think, positive way to, you know, to respond. And then have a conversation that focuses on that and that only. And then, at a different time, in a different place, so as not to sort of pollute the positiveness that you would have just accomplished with that conversation that I just asked you to have, you might come back and address him, him saying that he wants to somehow, you know, continue to be friends with this ex-mistress. And, you know, depending on the degree to which you've succeeded to connect and build up goodwill, you know, you might use an I feel sentence to let him know how that makes you feel. You might also consider educating him about how to rebuild trust in a marriage post-infidelity, which of course doesn't include any contact with the ex-mistress. You might consider exposing him to some of the audio files or sections in the program. You might consider, again, a session with me or Elise or David or Mimi or somebody local. In other words, again, similar to my response to a couple of other questions, it sounds like your husband means well, but is just ignorant about how to move forward from this situation. A lot of people, they're just naive and, again, ignorant, and they think, okay, I made a mistake. I'm going to apologize to my wife. I'm going to be like, do right by everybody. Like, I'm going to continue to be friends with this ex-mistress so that she doesn't think I'm a jerk. And I'm going to apologize to my wife and start to do the right thing and try to rebuild my marriage so she doesn't think I'm a jerk. And everybody's going to be okay. It's just, you know, it's coming from a good place, but it's just stupid. It's just it's ignorant. And people just don't know. They just don't understand. They don't understand. They don't have any experience and know how that's going to play out. So you need to try to educate them and put them in a situation where they can learn about, you know, how to conduct themselves in such a situation. But again, I would make them two separate conversations. Okay, let's try to squeeze in one or two more questions.
Hey, Mort, how you doing? It's Brian.
Brian, good evening.
Amazing. Hey, you said something last week, and I've been thinking about it because ever since I've joined your program, I've grown so much, and I'm always looking for new ways to grow outside of just listening to you and going through the program and reading your books. So I was wondering, you said you listen to, you love podcasts now. You listen to several podcasts. Could you tell us a couple podcasts that are very useful to people in our that you listen to help us grow?
Oh, that's interesting. So let's see. I'm picking up my phone right now. I hesitate. Okay. Look, if anybody wants to email my staff, I have a list, a recommended book list, which I feel I'm going to answer your question. I'm not avoiding it. But I feel much better about that recommended book list than I do about this podcast list I'm going to give you. I'll explain why in a second. I think I also have a recommended movies list. I think I have that posted also, which you can email my staff about. And I feel really good about that. The problem with the format of podcasts is that, as you know, if you listen to them, that they're pretty spontaneous. They're not really tight and well-scripted or thought out. Now, that can be an advantage or a disadvantage. In other words, one of the reasons why people like podcasts is because it's longer form, it's more free-flowing, it's more spontaneous. You really kind of, you know, get a sense of people's personalities. And it's not so tightly scripted. But, you know, the result of that is that people aren't always so thoughtful and you don't know always what you're going to get. The other thing that's worth noting, and here I'll start to get into the details of my answer. Like, let's take, for example, Tim Ferriss. So I listened to the Tim Ferriss podcast. I hesitated to mention it. I just did because I want to answer your question. You know, you're asking me a straightforward question. You know, who do you listen to? Okay, I listen to the Tim Ferriss podcast. But I hesitate to recommend it because Tim Ferriss' podcast is not so much about Tim Ferriss. It's really him interviewing fascinating people, people who are experts or highly competent in their fields or lines of thinking. And depending on who he's interviewing, that, you know, and I'll reference something I said earlier in the evening, depending on who he's interviewing, that may or may not be somebody whose ideas I really want to listen to. That may or may not be somebody who is coming from a really good place. And so you have to be careful, because a lot of these podcasts are people interviewing other people. And, you know, if someone's promoting things that, you know, I don't believe in, or things that I don't think are, you know, ideas that are perverted, or ideas that are sick, or ideas that are just not healthy and good for the world, you know, so I don't really want to listen to that. So, you know, so I try to learn a little bit about the person he's interviewing before I really listen to the whole thing and decide whether or not I think this is the kind of influence that I want to be around. The other thing about Tim Ferriss is he's a very interesting guy, very interesting. I like the fact that he's really into being introspective. He's into learning and growing. He is a ferocious reader, which I really respect and is unusual these days. He's very well read. But, you know, he's got some ideas that, you know, I'm not really a fan of. You know, for example, you know, he promotes the use of psychedelic drugs for purposes of introspection. You know, I don't think that's good. So anyway, Tim Ferriss is one. The other is How I Built This. It's really a show more about it's more about business than personal growth. But I find these people who have been really successful in business very often have competencies that we can learn a lot from, and to hear their stories about how they grew their businesses through really, you know, forming important relationships, I think is very, very interesting and very worthwhile. There's a podcast called The Knowledge Project that's worth listening to. Again, you're hearing from lots of different kinds of people. So it's, you know, you really have to be able to eat the fruit and spit out the pit. Some of the people that they're interviewing and are very good and interesting, and some of them are, you know, not so much so. I listened to Jonathan Sachs. He, I can wholeheartedly recommend. His content is phenomenal. What else do I listen to? Hold on, I'm just looking at my... What just happened here? What's that guy's name? One second. He actually, this guy actually interviewed me. I was on one of his podcasts. One second. Here it is. Front Row Dads. This guy is interesting. Front Row Dads. John, what's his name again? Oh, sorry. What's the guy's name? It doesn't matter. You can just Google Front Row Dads. That's a good podcast. I like what he's talking about. He's promoting good values. I listen to TED Talks. Again, it really depends on who's talking, but thoughtful people very often with interesting ideas. What else? Yeah, anyway, there you go. Let's try one more question.
Hi, Mort. Thank you so much for taking my call. I didn't hope. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So my name is Anna. I've been in the program for about 6 months now, and my husband moved out a month ago, and the place from where he moved out, where I live now, it's not our family home. It's not where we got married. It's a place that we rented together in September. He wasn't even sure that he wants to move out here, and at some point he liked the place, but the point is he moved out from here. So given that it's not our family home, I didn't really apply your your...
Wait, I'm sorry. I don't know if I was distracted. I didn't understand. He moved out to where? A place that you own, but it's not your family home? Is that what
you're saying? No, from where he moved out. So from where I live, the place from where he moved out, it's not our family home. So where I live now and where we used to live for the past few months, it's not our family home.
Okay.
It's just a place that we rented like a few months ago. So I didn't really follow your approach whenever we were talking about in the program about not accepting his new place so that he can move back in a family home.
It wasn't your family home if it's where you were living?
It's because we only lived there for a few months, and when we moved here, he wasn't even sure he wanted to move with me because he was already considering divorce and separation.
So where do you consider your family home?
We don't have any. We're kind of we used to rent many apartments. We like to move along.
Yeah, no, I mean, I hear what you're saying, that you didn't have the kind of rootedness that other people might have in their family home, but relatively speaking, that place that you're describing where you lived as a family for those few months, that was your home.
Okay,
but go ahead. I was just trying to process all of that, which I just did. Now, what's your question?
Okay, and so my question is, now that I didn't really follow through in the sense that I went to his new place, I even helped him to get some furniture because he didn't take anything from here, and I felt bad that he doesn't have anything, and I wanted to be helpful, so I got him furniture, and I shared the kitchen stuff with him. So I'm wondering if I did a mistake by doing that, and if there's like a damage control I could do, because now he makes clear distinction, this is my home versus this is your home, and he tells it to our kid, like, you're going to stay at mama's place versus papa's place, and I just don't know how to handle this whole situation now. And if I could just add one caveat, because I think it could be important, that his new place is actually much nicer than where I live now, and if we were to reconcile, I think it would have been better, it would be better if we moved to his new place altogether.
I'm not sure about that. I'm much less concerned about how nice it is and more concerned about, I'm less concerned about the house and more concerned about the home. And, you know, when you succeed to reconcile, I'd like to see all of you return to that place that you were together in before, or, you know, some new place that could be as nice or even nicer than what he has now. But, you kind of got yourself into a difficult situation. But I think the best advice that I could give you is... Look, I think you recognize that you made maybe a mistake, depending on how you feel about my answer to your question. you know that, and if that's the case, I think you should just change gears and follow the advice that you recognize that I gave. It'll be a little awkward because he won't quite understand, like, you know, why are you viewing my home differently now than you were. But I think you should. I do think that's what you should do. I think, just to be clear, I think you did make a mistake. I'm telling you that not to make you feel bad, but to help you go forward. I think you made a mistake, and therefore, I think you should try to get yourself back on course. It sounds like you listened to the audio file where I talk about what that means to be on course. So I think you should follow that advice. It's going to be a little awkward at first. It's probably going to require a little explanation. And that'll be difficult. But I think that that's the path that you should take. Go from there. Thank you all for your excellent questions. I hope you found my responses helpful. Keep up the good work. Let me know what else I can do to help. Good night, everybody.